The dickheads are presented in color.
Hey, dickheads! Like a pink laser beam of truth beaming from five locations to your brain hole. We are your dickheads, and all hands are on deck today for this interview. We've got two guests, so it's more or less a panel about a play, 800 Words, The Transmigration of Philip K. Dick. And we're going to get to that play in a little bit, but we are going to talk to Victoria Stewart, who wrote it, and Reggie Herbert, who just co-directed the play and actually starred as Philip K. Dick in a production of it. So, you know, we read about this, and of course, being that we are dickheads, we had to have this discussion. So, just to introduce us, if you're somehow first time finding us, I'm David Agronoff. I am the author of The Last Night to Kill Nazis, which you can find in bookstores everywhere. If you want a book about a vampire killing Nazis, I got you. Also with us today, Professor Wilson, David Harlan Wilson, our co-host, and he is the author of...
Many things, but I will foreground the that I am the editor-in-chief of Anti-Oedipus Press, which is putting out an upcoming series called Exegetics PKD Studies. More on that soon.
Yeah. We're very excited about all the books coming out on there. The last of our co-hosts is...
I'm Langhorne J. Tweed.
Yeah, there you go. Langhorne J. Tweed joining us from here in San Diego. You're still in black and white, Larry.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
I like it. It looks cool. I wish I was in black and white.
Don't take my thing.
That's the only reason I don't. I don't want to try to one-up you.
Now, we're going to get to Reggie. For that. We're going to get to Reggie a little bit later. But, Reggie, you can ask questions at any time if you want to. But we'll get into your bio in a little bit. But Victoria Stewart is one of our guests tonight, and she is the playwright behind 800 Words, The Transmigration of Philip K. Dick. But Victoria has written a lot of stuff. And you started before you went to the University of Iowa School for Playwrights. But before that, you worked for quite a while in being a stagehand. Was that your first experience with working in the theater?
Yeah. I think like a lot of theater people, I started by doing musicals and stuff in high school, but pretty quickly realized I wasn't that talented, and then moved into being backstage, being a stage manager and production manager, and did that for about 10 years after college, and then merged into being a playwright.
Right. So, but let's get your background, where you grew up and how you got into writing, because, you know, for most people, writing is something that, you know, storytelling comes very early. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, I was very interested in writing. I was an English major in college. I was surrounded by books. My dad was a book collector, and my brother owns a science fiction fantasy bookstore / game store. So I definitely, you know, books were always everywhere. I didn't really think about being a playwright until working in the theater backstage for a really long time. And so I was kind of writing prose and things like that. But I didn't really start to commit to being a writer until 10 years after. I kind of had hit a juncture in being a stage manager where I was like, do I want to do this for the rest of my life? And I realized I wasn't going to do this for the rest of my life. It's a really hard job.
A lot of babysitting.
Yeah. And also I kind of had hit a real pinnacle. I was the assistant stage manager on an opera that was doing a European tour. So it was like really as good as it could get, you know, I was making a ton of money and, you know, going to Vienna and Rome and Paris. And it was like, so this is as good as it's going to get, really. Is this really it? Is this where I'm going to stay? And I was like, nope. So started at the bottom and went to graduate school for writing.
Yeah, stage management in opera is very different than stage management in regular theater because you have to follow the libretto and everything like that. And so are you musically inclined as well?
I actually, it was a very strange, it's the only opera, I worked on Three Penny Opera, but this was the only opera I ever worked on. And it was this avant-garde opera by Peter Sellers and Tan Dun, who's Tan Dun won the Oscar for the music for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So it was this very strange avant-garde opera with all this video and lots of water on stage. It was very, very complicated and very cool, and I'm glad I did it. It really was, I really kind of hit a wall.
Right.
So with, you got a leg up on understanding how to write a play by being in the mechanics of it, I would imagine, right? So that probably gave you a heads up when you went to grad school, right, over some of the people.
Yeah, it's definitely true. And I've had a lot of directors say that, you know, that they're like, you're actually the calmest playwright we've ever had in the room because I really understand a rehearsal process and really understand like, oh, it's not going to be, you know, it takes a while for actors to get the play under their belts. And I'm not one of those people who's freaking out. And also, you know, I've had people comment like, oh, you actually wrote a costume change into, you know, like you understand that they're going to have to completely change their costume. So, so I have a pretty good understanding of the mechanics of it while I'm writing. And it's an important part of the writing of it for me.
Just real quickly, you did grad school at University of Iowa, and if I'm not mistaken, that's a really good school for the creative arts. How was your experience there? Did you like it?
It was great. I mean, yeah. It is a really great school, and it's I wanted to go there because a lot of my favorite writers had gone there. I was a huge Andre Debus fan, the short story writer, and he went there and but some of what really works about it is that you are, I don't want to say in the middle of nowhere. Iowa City is a beautiful college town. Iowa is a great place. I stayed there for a year after I graduated. But it is a place that gives you a huge amount of time to write. And it's also very affordable, which is really important when you're trying to make it as an artist. And it's just an exciting place because there's so many people who are writing great work. I was in school with people, you know, right now my friend David Adjmi has a play on Broadway. I mean, I was in school with a lot of really amazing people. So it's just a, you know, very inspiring place to go.
And it seems too that it's not just like, you know, I don't know how to say this where it doesn't come off sounding snooty, but there's more than just
really, you worry about sounding snooty?
Yeah,
that
no,
I sound like you.
No, but you know, there's writers who are very well known for writing works of literature, but there's also David Morrell taught there for a long time and wrote First Blood, and William Ten, who the science fiction writer, was there for a long time, you know. And so I think it's not just you know, there's writers who write popular fiction who taught there as well. So
yeah.
So what was your first play that you got produced, and how did that journey start?
Oh, that's kind of interesting because I'm trying to. it was a long time ago. I really was not a writer before I went to graduate school. So I actually applied to Iowa with my first play. That play is about the filming of a 1949 movie, In a Lonely Place, the Nicholas Ray movie with Humphrey Bogart. So I applied with that play that I wrote while I was on tour with this crazy avant-garde opera. And I guess the first thing I really had produced, though, was was in graduate school. And also, that's the wonderful thing about Iowa is it has lots of opportunities to just put up your plays and actually see them done from beginning to end. And with actually, you know, a lot of times early on, a lot of playwrights just have the experience of hearing their plays, you know, so you have a reading, but you don't actually get to see it produced and have to deal with the reality of it being produced. And Iowa gives you just a ton of opportunities to see it produced. So by the time I left Iowa, I'd had 4 or 5 plays produced fully at the school. And sometimes it was me directing it in a classroom, but still you get an experience of what an audience is going to think. And then outside of school, the first thing I had done was a kind of controversial play that I wrote called Live Girls that is about a theater person that I worked for, and she's interviewing a porn star, and it's sort of a little bit, you know, it's kind of a meme about my experience of, you know, being a stage manager for somebody.
Now, is this a full length or was it a one act or?
No, it's a full length. It's a full length. And because, it, you know, but also I think it's an interesting play about with good parts for women. So it's three good parts for women, and very producible in one space. So that was my first play that was produced professionally, and was produced in a bunch of different places, in, you know, Boston and Philadelphia and New York and Chicago.
Have you ever written a play with just saying screw it, not thinking about the things that work on the stage, or can you not take the stage manager out of your heart?
That's a great question. I mean, honestly, the play that I wrote, 800 words, probably is something where because I was dealing with his brain, I kind of had to sometimes let go of what was, how it was going to be done, and let it, and often leave it up to the director. I mean, you know, one of the conceits in the play is that he's obsessed with Wagner, and he loves this moment in Wagner where time becomes space, in Parsifal. And so in at one point at the end of the play, it just says time becomes space in the stage directions. And so that's up to the director, nice, how they want to portray that, you know.
So you also have worked for the screen a little bit, and yeah, it started to transition to screenwriting. Has that changed how you work on plays as well, or change? You know, that's operating with a lot of different muscles, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very, it is a different skill. And I had a producer that kind of the meanest thing he could think to say to me sometimes was, you know, this is a scene from a play. This isn't, you know, and so it meant that it was a very long dialogue driven scene and I needed to break it up with some visuals. I mean, we actually got along very well. He was actually a very smart producer, and he was right. They are very different skills. And you know, you want to approach, I mean, I really admire people who can just bop back and forth. I am a theater geek, so I'm kind of not going to stop being a theater geek, just, you know, even though it's not where the money is. We do it for the love.
No, if folks are wanting to check out more of your work, before we get into the PKD nerdery, because once we start talking PKD,
I'm sure
it's all over. Can you give us one or two of your plays or pieces of work that you feel like most, you know, represent your work? Because that's the thing, is I want to check out more of your work, but, you know, I obviously coming to this from PKD, right?
Sure. I have two published plays. One play is called Hardball, which is about kind of the rise of a Ann Coulter-like political pundit. And then I have another play called Rich Girl, which is a modern day adaptation of The Heiress and Washington Square by Henry James. And they're both pretty representative of my work.
Well, so Victoria, how did you discover Philip K. Dick, and how did he become, you know, how did that become something that you wanted to write about?
I got to know Philip K. Dick the way so many people, the entry level drug that is Blade Runner. And, you know, I saw that movie. You know, again, my brother always had science fiction kicking around, but he was not a Philip K. Dick fan. And I, you know, so I think I read, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But I really didn't get into him until my 20s. And I had a boyfriend who was a big fan of Divine Invasions, the Larry Sutton, Lawrence Sutton book, which is a great, great biography. And I think that book goes is such a great comparison because it really does break down the how the autobiographical events in his life really manifest themselves into all of his books. I mean, of course, he wrote so many books, and so there are probably some that don't have to do with his autobiography, but I think that book makes a great case for looking through each of the events of his life. And then also, I think, you know, my background as a theater person, which is, and a lot of my plays have this, is kind of a meta theatrical, you know, thing where you're examining the creation of theater and the moments of behind the scenes. And so therefore with Philip K. Dick, he always was very interested in what if everything is just a, you know, a creation, what if everything is actually a false created event. And so that became kind of the through line in the play.
And so it's one thing to be interested, you know, but at the same time, you sat down to actually write a play. So you must, I mean, you wanted to explore those same questions of reality through him, or, you know, what got you to sit down and actually write the play?
Yeah, I think I approached it because I was interested in the creation of art and how much his autobiography does lead to it. And is there something, I think he's constantly questioning, like, is it something outside of me? Is it, you know, is it being beamed from God? Or is it something that's me? You know, is it all something that I'm creating in my head? Or is it something I'm getting from someplace else? And he's really wrestling with these issues of inspiration and where you, what is creativity and what is inspiration and where are those things coming from? And, you know, and a lot of those ideas are going back, you know, centuries to, you know, Bach and, you know, people who felt that they were divinely inspired to create. So I was just really interested. I think as an artist, I wrote it at the very end of my time at Iowa. And I think I was trying to figure out my own, inspirations and what was interesting to me as a creative artist, as a writer, and also what you give up, you know, because that's part of it, is he kind of loses a lot of things that he loves because he's so obsessed with his ideas and so obsessed with his, you know, so obsessed with his writing. And I think that's the question in the play, is like, what is too much? When are you too obsessed, you know? So those were all things I was wrestling with at the time.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question about this point of context? Because I obviously haven't seen. You guys haven't seen the play, have you, David?
No, I have not yet. Oh, no, I saw a clip of it.
I've seen it over and over again. What's wrong with you? How come you haven't seen it?
Well,
I didn't watch the whole play yet. So
I'm a bad.
No, I haven't seen it either.
No. Well, here's my. I've been looking online and. It's old, right?
It's old, yeah. Miller's like 20 years old.
Because when was the first performance? It was like in the
2007?
Well, the very first performance, I mean, I had it done at the end of my graduate school experience, and that was 2001.
Okay. I didn't know.
Yeah, so it's really old. But then the production that you can see clips of online is a production that I had in 2009 that was in Minneapolis.
Okay.
That's the one I saw clips of.
Probably, yeah.
Now, so one of the things that I think is curious about this too is if this was the end of your time at Iowa, what was the reaction to some, your teachers in your school that you were writing about Phil? Because it seems like an interesting choice. Did you have to educate people on who he was even? I mean, you probably had to have that conversation, the Blade Runner, Total Recall guy that we all.
Well, did. I think it's in the, it's in the very beginning of the play where he basically, it starts with like a scroll, like the way, Star Wars and, Blade Runner begins with the what was very typical in the 1980s with the scroll saying, this is where we're at, so explains who he is at the very beginning. I like to think I made a lot of converts. When we did it in Iowa, we bring in a bunch of theater professionals to watch it, and a bunch of people are like, I'm going to go and read some Philip K. Dick now. So I think a lot of people, and of course, a lot of people know, obviously, Blade Runner, Total Recall. They know the... sometimes that was a little bit of a barrier with the play, was that when I would give it to people, they wanted it to be more like a conventional science fiction Hollywood movie as opposed to being
we get that a lot with the books, everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone expects the books to be like that, and they never are.
Yeah, exactly. They're much more interesting and quirkier than that. Yeah. And that's why we who love him love them. But I found that sometimes people are like, well, I want it to be more like, Blade Runner, and to feel like a genre, as opposed to, no, he really is playing with these, really interesting ideas where things are just going to keep on changing on you. They're going to keep on shifting, and you're going to have these really, interesting ideas. I mean, every 800 words, you're going to have these new worlds. He doesn't stop. And I think so that sometimes was an issue in terms of getting theaters to commit to doing it, because it was just too weird.
So that begs the question, what is the play about? For those of us that haven't seen it, which I assume some of our audience hasn't. So.
Sure. So the play is about, the play takes place in the last few days of Philip K. Dick's life. And he is trying to figure out in the last few days. He doesn't, of course, know, because we don't know that it's the last few days of his life. He is eagerly anticipating that maybe Blade Runner is going to make him successful, financially successful. But he's also sorting through all of these memories about these divine invasions in 1974, where he had these visions of God, and he's trying to figure out whether they were real or not, and how they impacted his work, and whether by writing so much about them, whether he, sabotaged his career. And it's told in a very fragmentary way. So it kind of goes in and out of something that really happened. And then sometimes it's not something, sometimes it's kind of a fantasy of what happened. And a constant presence is his dead twin sister, who died when they were born together. And 2 weeks after they were born, she died. And he always felt, and this is in Lauren Sutton's book, he always felt he was sort of haunted by her. And so there's many, in a lot of his books, there's this dark-haired girl that passes through and kind of loves and hates him.
It's an odd relationship he has with his dead sister.
Yeah, so she's sort of an angel, but also she's constantly needling him and resents him. So she appears several times. And that's also part of the theatricality of it, is that, one woman plays several different characters, because she keeps on showing up. So she's like a teenage drug dealer in one scene, and then she's, a girl that Stanislaw Lem is trying to get him to sleep with. And so she keeps on showing up.
Lem is a character in the play too?
Yeah.
Lem is
nice.
Because, part of it is his grappling with his failures, because one of his thoughts with Stanislaw Lem is that is it paranoid or not, that he had this idea that Stanislaw Lem was trying to get him to trying to enlist him in the communist cause, and he wrote a letter to the FBI saying,
because Lem was such a communist, right? It's funny, those dark haired girls, they're really important characters, but making Jane and all these that character, it shows too that from my perspective as a serious dickhead, that you you know what you're doing, right? Like, Jane is such an important part of his pathology of, like, his whole life, right? Absolutely. And then, you know, so that's, I think that's really cool. So,
can I ask you a quick question about the title? You indicated, if I'm not, I think I was reading you right, that, you know, if you were to lay out the entire corpus of Philip K. Dick's texts, that every 800 words there would be something kind of new and innovative, and so new world of some kind, new doorway, what have you. Is that right?
Yeah, because he talks about that there's a science fiction writer who he loved, E.A. Vogt, who said that you have to have something new every 800 words. So he felt really strongly that was.
I knew that.
That's where it comes from. He talks about that in the play. Like, you have to come up with something.
Christ, I'm way behind.
I was going to ask, why not 700 words? Why not 900? But I wonder. What did Von Vogt say? Why 800?
I've looked at a lot into it, and as Von Vogt, like, that was just his theory of, like, to keep science fiction interesting, every 800 words you had to
Do you remember what episode we talked about that in? Because I don't.
Yes, we talked about it in the last All Thinking episode.
And your assignment is to do some research and tell me exactly why the number 800.
800.
Yeah. All right, I'm on it. But yeah, so Reggie, you directed this play. Was this your introduction to Philip K. Dick, or were you already a Philip K. Dick fan?
I was a fan. That's how I found it. I am a science fiction literature fan. I have been for some time, and mostly because I feel like there is no better genre. I mean, you know, it's art, so it's, like, subjective. So to me, there's no better way to examine the human experience, like, existential questions, but also, like, pertinent here and now sort of questions about humans' relationship to technology, how that influences our relationships to each other. How we define ourselves in relation to our physical world, but also our place in the universe. I feel like science fiction is the best way to do that. At least is the way that speaks to me the most. And I know it speaks to a lot of people. Like, it's a very popular genre for a reason. But I've been doing theater for some time as well, and they're just, I hate to say it, they're haven't been a lot of scripts and productions that really spoke directly to me, that, like, I felt was something that I was really, really excited about or passionate about, you know? And so I went in search of a show that had those things, and I Googled it. And that's what showed up. Thank you. For writing it.
I totally know. Really incredible. Because I worked basically 20 years in musical theater and opera, and you know, a lot of that is very much just audience satisfaction and all of that stuff. But very rarely did I get a chance to do an actual production that was worthwhile or worth, you know, having an actual voice to say something. Other than let's all sing and dance and have a good time, which I enjoy. I'm not gonna deny that it is what I did for a living. But it's great that you found something that really took hold of you, right?
Right. Reggie, you originated this, so you had to convince a bunch of people to do this with you. Can you tell us about that process?
Sure. Well, I mean. So I live in a small community in the northwest corner of Montana, Missoula, Montana, where the University of Montana is. And when I say small, it's not small for Montana, but I think we have like 75, 80,000 people during the school year. But we're a geographic anomaly. We're like 7 hours from everywhere, you know, so... We're like 7 hours from Seattle, like 9 hours from Boise, you know, like it just takes, we're kind of isolated, you know. And despite the fact that as far as Montana goes, we do like relatively we have a vibrant arts community, but I was finding little in the way of either casting opportunities or directing opportunities or really pretty much anything. And I come from like a DIY background. I grew up listening to and playing punk rock and that sort of thing. And I was just like, you know, I know how to do things professionally now, but it doesn't need to, you know, perfect is the enemy of good. I should just do this thing. This is just so incredible. I can't not do it. And so I asked a mentor of mine from graduate school if he would consider co-directing it with me, because if I don't know, I knew that it wasn't fair to other actors to be working with a director who's also in a scene with them, because that's just, it would just be, I didn't want to be doing a scene with someone and then just like stop and give them notes. That's just so rude. And it's just, I need to, I know that if I'm working with someone and if someone were to do that to me, I don't know if I could trust them again. And in order to do a good production and to work well with your fellow actors, you know, you really need to be able to be vulnerable with them. And I needed someone also to keep me on track and to not let me get a little too, I don't know, a better term, to have my performance be masturbatory. Like, I just really didn't want that either. You know,
it sounds so, like you were worried about the two roles, the director role and the actor role interfering with each other.
Yeah, I wanted them to. I didn't want to be a tyrant, and I didn't want to make it about me. It was about the show.
Right.
You know? So, but I really wanted to do the show, and I just didn't want it to, like, I wanted to both be in it, and I also wanted to, like, make sure that it was a good show. So I made sure that I found someone who knew what they were doing. You know, he was the head of the graduate acting program at UCSD. I think some of you folks are down there, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, I worked at the La Jolla Playhouse and UCSD for years.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, cool. Does the name Charlie Oates ring a bell?
No.
Okay. Yeah, he mostly taught movement, but he got his graduate degree here at the University of Montana, like myself, and so he's retired and living here now, but only semi-retired. He still teaches when they need him to, and directs when he's asked to direct in places around the country. So I was very fortunate in the fact that he agreed to help me out with this project. And I don't know, I work with a local independent living center, which they're, I don't know if you folks are familiar with, they're part of the independent living movement, which was subsidized by Section 508 from the 70s, ensuring that folks with disabilities have options when it comes to independent living. And so there are independent living centers all around the country. They're, you know, federally funded. And they have a satellite center, a program called BASE. They're an all abilities, like community engagement sort of center. And I go help them out with like their improv once a week and stuff like that. And we have a good working relationship. They're really great folks. And they agreed to let me run rehearsals and auditions and everything I needed to there. So I just worked my ass off. and I was very fortunate to get a group of actors that were really spectacular.
Just to clear it up for me, were the actors all disabled, or was this?
No.
They just provided the means for you to do certain aspects of the play, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They provided the much needed space for rehearsals.
Okay.
So
where do you pull from to get actors? Do they, given where you live, do they come from outside of town, or is it local house?
They're all local. There was one lady who commuted a little over an hour a day, which, you know, is not typical for Montana, but, you know, I did what I could for DIY advertising, but I also asked a lot of people, like, because I know a lot of actors. I asked a lot of actors that I knew who I knew were good. And that's for some reason not common practice in my area. I don't know why. But I was told by most of the folks who came and read for certain roles that they did it because I asked them. And I'm very grateful that they did it. So
did you just give them the play, or did you say, here's Philip K. Dick? Did you introduce everyone to Phil with just the text, or did you make people go on that deep dive?
Well, I don't know that it would have been reasonable to ask people to become Philip K. Dick aficionados. So, if they were reading for a specific role or something, you know, I gave them a breakdown of the roles that were available, and I told them, if they were people I asked, which role I would like to see them read for, and ask them if there was another role they would like to read for. And then, you know, I pulled sides from the play to read with them. And I did make some, you know, once they were cast as part of, like, I'm just going to use as part of, like, a dramaturgical research folder, I did provide them with some PKD novels, as well as the biography that was already mentioned, which was an invaluable resource for me. But, you know, some people read them and some people didn't. So
it must have been a strange audition process with trying to cast. Like, what did people read maybe from the play, but also people came in with, like, monologues and stuff like that, correct?
No, I didn't do it that way.
You didn't?
Okay. No.
You had them do scene work, or?
Yeah, so what I did was, I find that doing the cattle call style audition, where you just kind of ask random people to come in and do a monologue, it necessitates a callback. And I felt like I'd be able to tell by just interacting with them. So I'm blind, and I felt that if I was going to be Phil, I needed to interact with the person to just feel how they interacted with me, and also how they felt interacting with me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I made sure that everyone who was either going to, like, knew that they were going to come in more than a couple days in advance had, you know, their sides, so that they didn't, I think only like two or three people read cold, you know, and that was because they found out about them late and just got excited. And I was very happy to have them come, but everyone who came in, was prepared. And so, and I can't read off of a sheet, so I was memorized as well. And so, it was really just a lot of fun. I did have to take video, because that way I could, review it later. I could, you know, maybe make out a little bit more viewing it on a screen later. And then my wonderful partner is an experienced audio describer. So she did, help me with, you know, letting me know about some of the great physical work some folks did, which was essential for, some of the characters.
So you did get a sense of the physicality of people.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So that, it must have been a real amazing process too. Like, when now directing this, you're having conversations all the time about Phil's motivations and what Phil's doing, or why Phil's Phil, right, with the actors. Did you have any really funny experiences, like, trying to... Well, yeah, so then there was this pink beam, right? You know? Either one of you, Victoria, I mean, you must have had that experience developing the play, right? Do you have any funny experiences explaining who Phil was to somebody?
I don't know if I think, again, because the play kind of lays it out pretty well. I will say, and I commend you, Reggie, because it is, since you guys, you know, don't know the play itself, it is so full of text for that character. That character is kind of narrating and sort of like an MC, but then he's snapping in and out of scenes. And so I have to say, we had... I was part of a theater company that did it in Minneapolis, and we had this, you know, really excellent, you know, equity professional actor, you know, kind of stellar actor from the Twin Cities do it. And after the first week, he was like, I can't do this. Like, he was like, this is too, there's too much. There are too many words there. He was also teaching, so he's teaching a full thing of classes and then coming to rehearsal. And finally, my director kind of calmed him down and was like, there's paper all over the stage, because of course he's writing while he's talking and things like that. He's like, we can put the entire script on stage and you could read it on stage. He ended up, of course, completely memorizing it because he's an amazing actor, but it kind of settled him down that he could.
Sort of Marlon Brando style, right?
Yeah. I mean, he didn't need it. He learned everything. And he was letter perfect. But he did freak out because it was just it's a really big part. So
word heavy.
Yeah, it's very word heavy because he's just talking, you know?
Right.
And he's in every scene, obviously. So you don't get a break.
That does match his personality from the interview.
Right, yeah, it's a very propulsive energy in terms of how
It's a really good descriptor.
Yeah.
How did the experience of producing it change the way you saw Phil? Like, getting into his body and using his words and all that. Like, how did it change how you saw Phil?
That is an excellent question. I apologize. Do you prefer Tori?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Thank you so much for writing this spectacular play. I spent a lot of time going back and forth reading the biography you mentioned and the one that you put in the acknowledgments, and it was, you know, a wonderful resource. And it so thoroughly investigated his life, and then at the end, you know, his body of work. And it was able to contextualize all of his books that I had read. And one of the reasons that I loved the books, loved most of the books of his that I've read, that they hit really hard in a way that the answer isn't handed to you, and often because there is no answer. But the one of the reasons that they're also palatable is that he's aware of the fact that a lot of the time they're kind of inherently ridiculous, and he's sarcastic and slightly self-deprecating. That humor comes through in the novels, you know, and in the short stories a lot of the time. But reading his biography several times and, you know, listening to hours of interviews and some documentaries, I was like, it gives me a compassion for a guy who, like, really wasn't, and this is my opinion, but, like, not really a stand-up spectacular human being.
That's true.
Very true.
he just put it out. He just put what he had out there and made jokes about it, and, like, really wasn't necessarily a great person. But I don't know. I guess I'm not really making much of a point.
It's good to find someone else that believes that he had a sense of humor.
Oh, my God.
A lot of people don't see that sense of humor in his writing. And we've been arguing about that, you know, since the beginning, right, David?
Yeah, we've always...
He's hilarious, and no one realized how hilarious.
That's what drew me to his writing. His humor. Yeah. His humor.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even just like him, you know, the characters, like, arguing with the door, trying to get out of the...
Yeah.
You know,
that's one of David's favorites.
Yeah.
How can you not see that as funny?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's the difference between PKD movies and
I think that's exactly right. I think that's the moody, you know, Blade Runner. It's all rainy all the time, as opposed to, like, his books are full of life and humor and it's really, I mean, it's funny. Like, the one of the things that happens in the play is that they talk about him being a prankster. You know, I mean, Lawrence Sutton talks about him being so. At one point, he's playing a prank on his agent and serving him make brandy, which is something I think that's mentioned in the Sutton book. And then that's the whole thing, is that finally, you know, his agent was like, well, I thought that all this God stuff was just a prank. I thought this was something you were playing on us. And he, like, suddenly it kind of backfires, like his sense of humor and his very buoyant kind of humor kind of backfires when it's like, oh, you thought this was all a joke? You know, it's not, you know. Yeah, I mean, so to answer the question about, like, what I discovered, I mean, so one of the things, I'd be interested to hear how Reggie handled this. So in the actual play, Victoria Stewart, the playwright, show up as a character because, of course, Philip K. Dick put himself in his own, you know, especially these works dealing with God, and, Philip K. Dick would show up as a character. So I was like, I got to see what this is like and how uncomfortable it is. So I never played myself, thank God. But I actually always got a playwright to play me, which was really fun. So that was something where I got to experience the experience of, like, how do I portray myself in a work of fiction, in a work of creative work? How is that, you know, how does that, I don't know, change your feeling about the work itself? I mean, it is, especially the first time I did it was like, this is really weird. This is really uncomfortable. So I'd be interested, like, Reggie, in terms of having Victoria Stewart show up as a character, what was that experience like staging it?
I remember where I was, because I read everything in headphones coming off my smartphone. I remember where I was when I read this play the first time and you as a character showed up. I was like, you know, so, because, you know, having read, like, Valis already at that point, I was like, she knows what she's doing. And it wasn't difficult. You wrote it in. I apologize because I understand that I can't possibly know for certain, but it seemed fairly apparent to me how you portrayed yourself. And there, I cast someone who, she's a local filmmaker and a screenwriter as well. She teaches long form improv in town as well, and an excellent human. She hasn't really done much theater, and there's something that happens to some folks that have been theater actors for a long time. They get, like, this theater voice, and it's just, luckily, you know, that wasn't something that we really had a ton of, but there were some of us that were more used to doing a voice that everyone can hear from, and, you know, her, I'm not saying that she wasn't audible or anything like that, but she came across as a lot more grounded in than some of the rest of us who had been up there being tossed around by, like, where are we in space and time right now? And I was like, stop asking that question. It won't help you now, you know? So, and I had her seated in the back of the house for the whole show. And in the moment where reality shifts, because it shifts fairly frequently, we had a very, very small sound cue from our sound designer that was really beautifully executed every time reality shifted. And I was really the only one next to a cat who was aware of it ever happening, really. So I was able to do some physical work, moving the time shift. And then all of a sudden, there she was coming up out of the audience, talking to me. Nice. And so it's a really wonderful scene.
Well, that sounds great.
Hey Tori, or both of you, the main intertexts that you take from for the play, so far we've kind of referenced Ubik, Valis, androids, and transmigration, of course. Are there other dominant intertexts there?
I mean, those are the big ones. I feel like we also hit, we also hit Owl and Daylight pretty hard. He's working on that one. And in general, the exegesis, you know, just all those lot of sect, because that's also, he's like, I'm not sure he was actually trying to do this, but it's a little bit of a conceit in the thing, which he's trying to get his agent to publish the exegesis, which I'm not sure.
I don't think he tried.
No.
Yeah.
But that's it. Thing he's like, I'm gonna finish it, you know, it's only 8,000 pages and I'm gonna finish it and then you're gonna want to do it.
if I'm not mistaken, there are chunks, especially at the end, where direct text that we're using on stage is I remember reading in the exegesis. I'm like, oh, we're just saying straight up exegesis words right now.
Yeah, so there are chunks from that. Time Out of Joint was a really important book for me, and it was an important kind of a gateway book for me. And so, therefore, I think that and just the way things just drop away in that book is kind of the way he moves from scene to scene in this.
It's one of his best. So.
I love that book. I love that book so
especially
much.
Especially in the early days.
Yeah, yeah. So that's definitely that's one of the big ones.
I have to ask on because the unfinished is my wheelhouse. With Owl in the Daylight, was your source the final interview that he gave with Gwen Lee? And God, I wish we'd gotten that book.
You read Tessa's adaptation of it?
No, family. I know the family put the kibosh on it. The thing is that he made four attempts at writing a novel that he was going to call Owl in the Daylight to fulfill that contract, and that the one in that interview was the fourth attempt. Mm-hmm. And that was the one that he most likely was going to write, but he chased three other ideas before that. But that's why I had to ask, because I know that he did three other attempts, but they are less known than.
Also, of course, I have to remember my own play, which I haven't written for 20 years. But I mean, one of the things is that in the, you know, music is very important in the play, Parsifal. But so, you know, part of the thing in Owl in Daylight is that the character's a composer, right? That's the version we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, it's he's a composer and he meets aliens who've never heard sound before.
I think I still have that entire scene memorized. If you want a brief recap, just
yeah. Well, and so the thing about and a lot of that Owl in the Daylight version was he was improvising during an interview and then decided to chase it. And so we know that
some of us call that lying, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because his third attempt, he told his agent in a letter, like, this is the novel I have in progress, and that letter is the only thing he wrote of it.
Right.
And so you never know, right? And that's the one
at that point.
Yeah, that's the one I teach in the formula class. I call it Peaceland, but he was trying to sell it as Owl in the Daylight. And that one is very 1953, Phil. It sounds like he wrote it in 1953. But it also has vast active intelligences, so it has other things going on. But anyway,
if I may, I just wanted to give Tori some props there, because if you folks haven't, you know, experienced the play in any form, the way that Owl in Daylight comes into the narrative, it comes right on the heels of Victoria, the character in the show, as well as Phil's cat, he finds out he's going to die that night. He becomes aware he's in a play. He finds out he's going to die. And then he snaps back into a meeting he was having with his agent. And it's like, please don't think I've been wasting my time and I don't have a legacy to be remembered by. And I'm working on a new book. And then he makes it up on the spot so that he, and I don't know, just the way that you work that into the narrative, yeah. Given like the trail that we had of what Alan Daylight was, you know, that projected
sounds,
to be.
Sounds almost historically accurate.
It's very close. Yeah.
So, yeah.
What was part of that story, the thing that he pitches in the interview is this idea of, you know, being kind of entered by an alien. And again, this choice of, you know, do I give in to this inspiration that's killing me? Or yeah. do I walk away from the gift that I'm given? And it's really heartbreaking. One of the things when we're talking about, you know, him being funny and him being that biography, which I can't shut up about, but you know, it is a book that when I finished it, I was sad because I never, you know, I felt like I knew him and I was sad mm-hmm. to leave behind, you know, there, like, I, there was something, you know, it was like feeling like a friend had died, you know.
I feel like so I'm still in low key mourning that the show is over. You know?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Reggie, well, did you get a full video of it, of the whole thing? And will it be available?
We were contractually obligated to not do so. It was, it was a live event. So, you know, there were 5 performances.
There are a lot of rules about that kind
there
of
are lots of theater. Rules.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well,
I have to say I have an illegal version. I probably shouldn't admit it on Paul. No, I mean, we...
You find it on Pirate Bay.
I know. Well, it's funny because, you know, you're not allowed to because of equity rules. And yeah. But immediately the guy who played Philip K. Dick was like, can I get a copy of it? Because it's incredibly useful in grant applications. So it's, you know, the whole thing is he was completely compliant. You know, he knew that he wasn't supposed to have it. But he's like, I will use this. So
I actually like that rule. That's a good rule. What about the script? Is that available anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, we do actually have a published version because it was presented by the theater company that, you know, I had a theater company collective in Minneapolis. And so it's published with that in our analogy. But I can also do a version. I'll send you a PDF.
I would love that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, this play, you know, how does it feel, Tori, to every time it gets produced again, like that's got to be a new feeling of like, especially with somebody like Reggie who clearly gets it, right? Like that's got to be like a pretty cool feeling when this play that you wrote so long ago keeps resonating with people.
It is cool because I have to say it took a really long time for it to get produced. Like we, you know, I did it at Iowa and there was a lot of buzz and a lot of people really liked it, but everyone kind of, again, sort of wanted to make it more conventional and wanted to make it more genre-y. And so I kept on getting sort of, you know, nibbles. And then finally I had a great little company in Seattle do it. And, you know, and then it's had like little productions. And then I produced it myself in Minneapolis because I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to see it the way and actually we sort of in many ways recreated the Iowa production.
Were you involved in the Pittsburgh production?
Not really that much. I mean, actually a little bit in that basically one of the actresses from Iowa, she was in my class graduating from Iowa, an actor there. She, you know, basically took it to Pittsburgh.
Oh, nice.
And she played, she had played Tessa in Iowa. And so she loved the part. She wanted to play it again.
Oh, cool.
She kind of got together. Yeah. She got people together to do it in Pittsburgh. Yeah. So yeah, it is very gratifying because I really love this. You know, I put a lot of myself in it. I literally put myself in it,
yeah,
but I did a lot of myself in it. And I, you know, I guess I'm an evangelist for Philip K. Dick's work in general. And so I really do, Yeah. So it is very gratifying. It was very gratifying to when Reggie reached out and was interested in doing it. And, you know, my agent at the time, you know, they always want, you know, they want the big fish, you know, they want the big, you know, and so therefore they often ignore like a small company doing something. And I'm like, let him do it.
Thank you.
Because I'm like, if someone wants to do it, I'm like, let them do it. You know,
thank you. Audiences were very receptive.
Oh, great, great. Yeah. So yes, it's very gratifying to
have. So Tori, do you happen to be a Eugene Ionesco fan?
Sure. Who's one of
Everything you've said about this play just reminds me of him every time you're talking about the meta element and everything like that. I immediately think of him. So
definitely. He's a giant.
Tori, just in terms of the writing, a problem I have, like I've been a writer for like over 20 years, and just a few years ago, it's hard for me, like if a few years pass, it's hard for me to read just recent books of mine without wanting to revise them and all of that. So since you wrote it so long ago, with every new performance, do you find yourself saying, oh, I could add this here or do this? Or is it kind of fixed for you in your mind or memory?
The truth of the matter is I did a huge amount of, like, you know, because it kept on getting read all over, you know, it was read by a lot of theaters. And so I'd go to another reading, then I'd go to another reading. People had all these problems with it. So I kind of have it locked in. But even, you know, when we did it in Minneapolis, we were, and in many ways, we were trying to recreate the Iowa production. You know, I still was doing some revisions, and I still haven't quite gotten like the certain aspects. Like, yeah, there are definitely things that if I ever got a big production, I would re-enter it. I don't get a chance to see, you know, I didn't get a chance to see Reggie's version. I didn't get a chance to see the Pittsburgh version. I've only seen two of the productions that happened since graduate school.
Sorry, go ahead. I said, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, I'm sure if I watched another production, I'd be like, oh, I didn't get that.
But also, plays get changed all the time, right?
What?
In rehearsals and in the course of anyone looking at it, you know, plays get changed subtly.
Yeah.
So who knows what version comes out at the end?
There's a whole chaotic scene that kind of is going from Victoria Stewart character showing up, and there's a lot of chaos, and I bet I would, if I were ever in a rehearsal room, I'd probably do some work on that scene.
So Reggie, speaking of your production, did you do any subtle rewrites or changing?
I mean,
not to put you on the spot or anything.
I mean, no, I will, and
thank
I'll
you.
Just, no, yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just come clean, in that the character who plays Phil's agent,
Russ Galen was his name, but not that it matters.
Yeah, I know that in real life for sure.
Yeah.
But the gentleman who I cast to play him had some severe health issues arise several days before rehearsals began. And we did not have a good option except for a wonderful actress. So I cast her in that role. And Tori, I apologize if that was inappropriate, but that is the only thing that we did, I think.
I'm sure there's a million pieces. Yeah, I'm sure there's a million pieces that fall into place here and there, and you just kind of have to roll with certain things.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole thing about theater, is it's very alive and active in that sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. What is the part for, as the writer of the play and as the performer of the play, starting with Victoria, What do you hope is the conversation that the play will continue to cause? Like what are you wanting? What's the conversation you want to be about Phil? How do you want to frame it through this play?
Well, that's such a great question. You know, I mean, I think it's really, for me, you know, I grew up actually in a pretty churchy household, a pretty Christian household. And so I think what I think how that's such a, I mean, I think the idea that his views about religion and the future, and they, you know, they're actually really expansive, even though he had very strong, you know, strong feelings, but they were big picture. Like everything that he was thinking were constantly expanding this universe. And especially, frankly, where we are right now in terms of, I don't know, religion taking America and making rules and stuff. You know, I would love to see these issues of, you know, how the religion and God and things like this are actually a positive manifestation of the world as opposed to a negative. So that's something I would love for me personally is the idea that he was really grappling, and he was grappling with doubt and he's grappling with faith, and those two things are part of each other. That it's not he does not, I mean, at the end of the play, he does not walk away going, oh, I know what happened. Like that's part of his realization, is that like faith is everything, and that trying to figure it out is everything. It's not, you don't have to come down to an answer. And I think what I found, especially lately with the way things are politically and the way the people I know who consider themselves Christian are feeling, they know the answer and they're upset at you that you don't know the answer, and they're going to force the answer on you. And I think for me, like I loved his view of the world. And I think the thing, you know, the reason why he survived for so long already is, and the why we keep on doing adaptations of his work, you know, in films, and is because he had such a broad idea of the world and what was possible. And I think, so that's something, you know, for me, I just want more about possibility and less about, you know, confining things and putting things in boxes.
And Reggie, specifically, have you seen, did you have anyone come up to you after the play in Montana? Like, what was the local reaction? Like, because we get a, you just did it, so you can talk about where the conversation, you know, went.
So, yeah, I went pretty far out of my way to try and do what I could to promote it, or I guess, I don't know, I don't like using the term market, but like, you know, do some advertising for it to ensure that folks who don't want to go see a community theater musical, if I can like get them into a theater space to see a show, I knew that they would appreciate it, because I think most folks think that like theater equals like poorly done Shakespeare or like another, you know, community theater musical. And there's nothing wrong with those things, but that's just not that's not what the show is. And so I was fortunate in that I did get a lot of those people, and you know, some of them were my friends, some of them were like people that, you know, heard about it through this or that. So I don't normally like going out and talking afterward, because I don't know, but I did, and I got many people being like, I need to go home and completely rethink my life. Like a lot of that. I got a lot of I don't know how I'm going to sleep for like weeks. What? And that was the point, you know? And like, it's not as though it's horror. It's not like they were scared in that way. You know, they thought it was hilarious, because it is, but it is really, it's like, it like rends you existentially. And really what I was hoping is that, much like Tori, you were saying, if we focus on our personal or philosophical or even, you know, dare I say spiritual life or something, on fixating on knowing everything there is to know and being able to answer these, you know, deep questions in a definitive way, being able to explain the why of everything, then you may, much like a beloved author, end up really hurting all of your personal relationships and maybe not really experiencing what is happening right here and right now. Because, like, at the end of the day, that's really all you have. And I don't know, I feel like it can help folks develop a deeper appreciation for those that you care about and people that care about you and things that you actually want to do with the time that you have. That's what the show meant to me. Thank you so much for writing it. And I'm very gratified that I think that was the effect we had on some of our audience members. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
Those are great answers to David's question.
Right.
Yeah. On that note, do you guys have anything else or?
No,
I just want to tell Reggie that I have family members that live very close to you, and I'm pretty sure they would not appreciate the play.
Well, then maybe it's a good thing they didn't
those
go.
Kinds of people that live in Montana.
Look, and I get it in a weird way too, Reggie. Your experience, since I have written and now lectured on PKD's formula last year because of Professor Wilson, like, kind of jokingly challenging me, I ended up writing a novel using the formula, and I basically tried to method act and write as not method. I didn't do amphetamines, but
method author.
Whoa. Where do amphetamines come into? Oh, like
PKD. No, I'm saying I tried to get into
the full nine yards.
Yeah. So with it, I tried to write this novel as Phil, right? And I tried to think as Phil. I tried to write everything as Phil and trying to comment on our modern world. And it was a really interesting experience because, like, I've written 15 novels as myself, but I've never tried to write one as Phil. And
in the style of,
yes. And it was a really weird experience and changed everything that I saw of him, and I'm sure playing him and using his words as, in writing a play. Like, these are all experiences that will train and teach you, like, to think about this person in a different way, positive, negative, sideways, you know? And yeah, I was really excited to read about the play and that it exists and that you're doing it and that it's another way that people are finding out about Phil and his work. And of course, we appreciate that. Larry, do you have any other questions about production or anything like that before we go?
Well, I wanted to ask about in the articles I saw that it was presented as a theater company doing this production. Is that your theater company? And are there future productions coming up?
Yeah. And to the answer to both your questions, yeah. When I started, once I got the venue and the rights to perform the production last year, it dawned on me that all of the financial transactions, like moving forward with this, were going to come across as income for me. And that is not accurate. That is wholly inaccurate because I was going to pay my actors and I was going to pay our designers and, all this stuff. And, despite the fact that I do work, I'm still disabled and receive some disability income, and that would really, really, really mess me up. And I really wanted to be able to keep doing this, so I did start a nonprofit. And I think it was the night after we opened, we received our 501c3 status. Nice. So I was really excited about that, hoping to be applying for some grants. And we do have two shows that we're hoping to do within the next year. One of them is Galatea by David Templeton. And there is a wonderful, wonderful adaptation of Solaris that did quite well at Fringe in like 2019 that I don't know was ever officially published, but I'm hoping to be able to do. It's just,
well, that'll make Anthony happy, our other host.
Well, I'm a Lem fan too, and I do know there is a great radio play of Solaris as
there
well.
There is, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually the best adaptation, hands down.
I think that this play is better, but it, at this point, I've only seen it, you know, read it on the page, so.
Yeah, well, that would be awesome. Yeah. Victoria, what are you working on right now?
I am writing my first novel. That's horrifying, because there are so many more words in a novel than there are.
Right? You can't fill it all with dialogue.
In fact, you have to not do that.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's a, you know, kind of a literary mystery about a creative writing teacher whose student is murdered. So then she's kind of uses the things that she was writing for the class as clues and things like that.
Are you under contract or are you just
I'm just writing it.
Good.
See what happens.
Yeah.
I sure hope that when it's published, there's either a digital version or an audiobook. I'd love to check it out.
I will let you know in 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I probably won't take you that long to write this thing. So, you've gotten, Victoria, you've done the most important equation in writing is ask plus chair equals writing, and you've done that. So, Professor Wilson and I will be in public here soon. Probably, I don't know. Be out in time, but we are doing the book release party for my next novel, People's Park. It's about the park where I grew up hanging out in Bloomington, Indiana, and it was the home to freaks and weirdos, and it was inspired by the real life. We had a guy named Electric Fred that used to hang out in our park, and Fred used to listen to static on his Walkman and write in notebooks. And a couple of years ago, I was talking about Fred with my wife, who used to work in a coffee shop there. And she said, Fred was a regular, and I have two of his notebooks. And my jaw dropped to the ground, and the novel People's Park came out a couple of years later. Yes. And
that's how you sell a book.
Yeah, that's a little. Yeah. It's a love letter to freaks, weirdos, and with a whole bunch of what is reality. Stranger Things with skateboards, I guess. People's Park. So that's out from Choir Books at the end of this month. And we will be doing the book release party April 7th in Bloomington, Indiana, the day before the solar eclipse. And then we'll be hanging out with William Shatner watching the solar eclipse the next day. I swear to God, we are. We are.
I will be in Austin, Texas, watching that same eclipse.
So on that note, as always, dickheads, keep it paranoid, stay paranoid, and we'll see you next time. Thank you to Victoria and Reggie for coming on and talking about 800 words, and we'll make sure there's all kinds of relevant links to experience more of that stuff and their work. And, you guys were awesome. And, we'll always take opportunities to talk about Phil with people in new and interesting ways. So please check that out. And, yeah, that's it. Stay paranoid, folks.